tuning in to the online broadcast network, AfterBuzz TV. Over 20 million weekly downloads in over 150 countries and your number one source for after-show entertainment. TV, the destination for TV superfans, producing aftershows for over 300 of your favorite TV shows, interviewing celebrities and showrunners, and bringing you behind-the-scenes exclusives. All thanks to E! Entertainment's Maria Menounos, producer Kevin Undergaro, and internet leader Akamai. Now, let the buzz begin!
Good evening, AfterBuzzers. Welcome to the People vs. O.J. Simpson American Crime Story After Show here on AfterBuzz TV. I am your host, Pegarad. You can find me on Twitter at Pegarad. I am joined by the lovely Stephanie.
Stephanie Georgie. How are you doing, everyone? You can follow me on Twitter at Stephanie Georgie.
Shaka Smith. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Shaka Strong.
Chris Howard at Chris Howard Live and at LegendaryLivingDaily.com and LegendaryLivingTV.com.
Before we get into Season 1, Episode 5, titled The Race Car, just want to remind you guys to go on to iTunes, subscribe, comment, give us 5 stars, subscribe to our channel here, check out all the other videos that we have, check us out on SoundCloud, keep the comments coming, we love hearing from you guys. Stephanie has a quick word from our sponsors at Blue Apron.
All right. You need to know how to cook, and not only do you feel you know your way around the kitchen, but cooking at home means eating healthier and saving money instead of ordering expensive takeout again. But where do you start? Blue Apron has you covered. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers all the fresh ingredients you need to create a home-cooked meal. Just follow the easy step-by-step instructions. Each meal can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. No overwhelming trips to the grocery store, no more sad takeout. No matter your dietary preferences, Blue Apron makes it a breeze to discover and prepare dishes like the steak au poivre with pommes brûlées and creamed kale. This is a new menu list. They have spiced chicken pitas with yogurt sauce and roasted potato wedges. And then we have a pinto bean and poblano chili with all the fixings. Cook with ingredients that you've never heard before, like watermelon radishes, farro, and purple potatoes, and recipes are between 500 to 700 calories per portion. Delicious and good for you. Right now, you can get your first 2 meals for free at blueapron.com/podcast. That's blueapron.com/podcast. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Ooh. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Ooh, nice.
Well done.
Ooh, they switched it up on me, though, guys.
Keeping those recipes.
Yeah. Menu's fresh.
So, guys, this episode was so good. Yeah. It's so good. We have so much to talk about. Let's start from the beginning. We'll just kind of go through. It starts out, it's 1982. Johnny Cochran's driving to dinner with his two cute little girls through Westwood Village, it looked like. I noticed a couple parts. I
did
went
you?
To UCLA.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Did you see that Habibi?
The Habibi Cafe.
That's your home.
And he gets pulled over for the third time in a week. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think?
It was intense, and it's funny because right when you see the siren go off, I mean, I had the same exact reaction he did, like, oh, man. And he says, here we go. My favorite part about that was the way that he had to preface his children and say, girls, what do we do in this moment? Because you kind of have to. Like, do you remember those Chewy commercials where what they would do is give a kid a Chewy because they'd be saying the most inappropriate and things that they shouldn't be saying? But it was just sad that he said that it's one of those things. I mean, my mom and dad never told me. What do you say when a cop gets? Nothing. Yeah. And who do you talk to? No one but your lawyer.
Yeah.
I mean, that was ridiculous.
Yeah, from my standpoint, having been stopped and having been in that situation, and it's crazy to me to see that, you know, it hasn't really changed much, at least for me, from my perspective. But I do like that they set it up because you get to see the ethos of Johnny Cochran. You see where he's coming from. Mm-hmm. A lot of times people say the race card, but it's almost a way of invalidating it and saying you're playing the race card as if it didn't exist at all. There was no validity to what you're saying. And so they're showing that ethos that he was valid, at least in the way he approached it, because there was an environment that he was dealing with.
Mm-hmm. I like seeing that too, because not only did he deal with a number of cases that dealt with the LAPD and the injustices, but he actually experienced it firsthand. So that was good to see. Yeah. Chris? Yeah,
for sure. Well, I mean, I think my man here said it just the right way, that it was there. So sometimes people think that spin is just spin, but spin is just somebody else's perspective. And I think that this whole episode spoke to perspective, how we each have our own unique perspective that we couldn't know unless we were there, as Darden says later.
Right. So we fast forward to 1995. Cochran is at church with his wife. They're leaving and there's cameras. And he decides to take this first big stab at Darden by saying, the only reason you were hired is because you're black and you're being used as a tool. So, ouch.
Right. I mean, I get why Darden would be offended by that, but at the same time, Cochran is just letting him know, I hope you're aware of it also. You know, you're allowed to stand where you want to stand, but don't play yourself either.
Yeah, and I think it was kind of the first time you saw, well, there is this issue, but is Cochran now using it in a different way? Because he doesn't know exactly why he's hired. Mm-hmm. And I think they showed us enough in the earlier episodes to really show that Marshall was his friend and really did respect Chris Darden as an attorney. So he may have, it looked to me that he was kind of brought on the team because of his expertise. Mm-hmm. And maybe Gil Garcetti kind of was like, I like the optics of this. Yeah.
Yes.
So it was the first time you see Cochran, who's well aware of a real problem, but maybe want to use it to also my advantage. Mm-hmm. In a way that it may not play out, but I'm going to play it for every scenario here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, see, I think Marsha's issue, like our guest, the guest that we had before that came in, the guy from the Associated Press.
Oh, Michael Freeman.
Michael, yeah. When he came in, he said that she was really colorblind, and that was kind of her problem going into it. She didn't see how it played out. But, you know, what would be wrong with him being brought in because he was black? I mean, wouldn't it be a strategic choice to put a black man in there because the race card was going to be a critical part of it, and put somebody in who could have rapport with the jurors? So I don't understand, and maybe somebody else would understand better from a different perspective, but I don't understand why Darden, why that he let that get to him mm-hmm. so much.
And also I would say, in addition to, for the jurors to see that, I think that also to shed light, should Marsha not be colorblind, you know, should be in an environment where they're not realizing it. So I would agree with you in that strategic aspect. Like, okay, but he's there to be like, just remember that there's also these issues, which he's done in this episode in regards to Michael Furman, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But it was beneficial for them to have him on the case.
In that regard. He did him. He did the black guy.
Well, I think it was the tension around the time mm-hmm. and the fact that it wasn't said. What if that was the case, why not approach him and tell him?
And tell him.
And so I think because of the tension of not actually telling him and wanting to admit it, and the tension of the time, that it was just a more racially kind of aggravated time, that's why you see him taking it kind of very seriously.
But, and you know, what popped into my head there too was when he went to school, he gave a speech later, but he said, I was always up against that, somebody thinking I got it because of the color of my skin mm-hmm. rather than because I worked for it.
And I think I think Marsha messed up without telling him, she just signed him Furman without kind of saying, look.
Yes.
We think you're smart. We think you're talented. Mm-hmm. But for the optics of this thing, this is why we're signing.
And yes, you're black.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's why also it's better for you to take this guy.
That's the one thing about Marsha that really made me upset was when she threw it out there casually. Why would you not think that he would have that reaction, you know? Yeah. And I get that she was trying to avoid that situation, but you said yourself, like, had she had just...
I think she was so colorblind, she didn't want to admit that that was part of the reason. Because she takes Furman. She said, I'll take him.
Yeah.
She was so colorblind and so committed to the fact
that... No, not then, but I'm saying initially.
No, I'm saying, I think even initially, she was so colorblind.
Yeah, I think so, too.
She was so committed to the fact that that was no part of him being on the team, mm-hmm. even though she really knew that was a part of what
helped. Maybe she was just in denial. She just didn't want to
admit it. She didn't want to admit to it. Yeah. So it was her own stubbornness of going, no, I'm this race neutral person if I even admit to a little bit.
You see, but this is what upsets me, because this is what is in that article that I wanted to talk about. She was identifying herself with it. She needs to not put her, like, okay, we get that it's not you, but do not dismiss the rest of your community and where you come from and the people that you're working for.
Yeah.
Or the majority of the people that you're working for.
It's racist, I have to say. It's racist to pretend that race doesn't come into the mix. If she was really making that choice based on the fact that he was black, she should have made it black and white and spelled it out.
Yeah, she just didn't want to. I don't think she wanted to be a part of what she saw as a problem, even though it would have been beneficial to her. So she ended up shooting herself in the foot, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you guys are listening, we want to hear what you think. So tweet at us at hashtag ABTVACS. We'll try to check our Twitter feed every once in a while and see what you guys have to say. So we see the two sides coming together. We have the prosecution saying that we have mountains of evidence. We've never had so much evidence before in any case. And then we have the defense saying, oh, well, we're going to, you know, the mishandling of the evidence and how it was contaminated. And so we see these two sides coming together. They're getting ready for the pretrial motion. Cochran says something that is so said beautiful. beautifully, sorry. He says, our job is to tell the story better than the other side tells theirs. Mm-hmm. And it's so true. It's like you're painting this picture, this story for this jury to just eat up. And they did a beautiful job of doing it. I mean, we all know how it ends up, but dang, they did a good job.
I think that's always, I mean, I've learned a lot through watching this show. That's always the issue. You know, I've got legal issues I've been dealing with, and it's really about who tells the story the best. And the end of the day, it's, you know, even history is, that's why they call it his story. His story, her story, it's all just a story. Who sold the story the best is what gets to last.
Yeah, I think, Marcia, or it was portrayed that they looked at it from a very formulaic way. You know, we have this evidence, we have this motive, we've established this, we've established that, rather than wanting to tell this kind of grander story. And I think you see the drawbacks of, you know, what the different strategies in doing so.
Mm-hmm. Darden and Furman. Ooh. Mm. He takes him into the room, he starts talking to him. And he doesn't get a good feeling. And he goes and tells Marcia about it. Do you think that was a good choice? Do you think?
I mean, I think what he said was right. I'm saying it as my perspective, which I want everyone to know, because I believe one person thought that I had said I was black. I'm not. I know I'm not. I'm Latina.
Are you sure?
Yeah. I'm Latina. So any comments I make, I am making from my own personal perspective. But I think that that's true. And I feel like I've been around certain people, and mostly I hear it because so many people are comfortable to say racial things and act a certain way around me because they don't know. But at the same time, they don't know that just because I don't look like it doesn't mean it's not going to affect me the exact same it would for, like, my sister who's, like, three shades darker than I am, you know? So I agreed with him 100%, and it upset me a little bit that she wouldn't consider what he had to say, like, more seriously.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, with any attorney putting someone on the stand, you have to be completely comfortable with the person you're putting on the stand, because just like we saw her eventually say, you know what, they'll see your animosity towards him. But she should have read that in the very beginning and thought to herself, well, if you have this after one meeting, maybe we shouldn't put this guy up, you know?
Right. Instead of covering it with massage it.
Exactly. So
girl,
I think
please.
She really, she was just so relying on this kind of formulaic idea of how to lay out evidence and having this witness.
It's very naive. Yeah.
Life doesn't
like
work that way.
Like if somebody acts polite, well, they must be polite.
Yeah. Oh, man. That was so naive. She's like, well, they must be. But she said it so kind and giddy, and it just made me upset. I'm like, oh, sweetheart, you live in Los Angeles in the city of acting.
Yeah.
What makes you think that? And it also bothers me because that's the difference between me and someone else who argues. I feel like I always get made out to be the crazy one just because I'm passionate the way that I speak. Oh, forgive me. Let me sit on my hands while I talk to you, and then maybe I'll be respected a little bit more. I talk with my hands, and if I want to say something, I'm going to say it the way that I want to. And it pisses me off that people consider a very specific way of being polite, and that if you act like it, that you are. Yeah. No, you're
but
probably being
fake. But who cares
what
they think? Yeah. You're fiery, and you're you. And
no, I'm saying, but in regards to that comment, that's why it was not to say.
And the whole Mark Furman thing, like I was having trouble as we were watching the episode, figuring out like why, you know, we know the guy's a racist, but I'm thinking of it in retrospect. I keep thinking I've got all this information that's going to come out about how racist the guy really shows up. And I'm like, don't you want to call him out for what he is? And then I'm forgetting, oh gosh, this is the prosecution. They don't want him to be a racist, but he is. And that's the issue in Chris Darden's consciousness. He's just like, I hate this guy.
Yeah, and he felt like he was being misled. He knew. He felt that, he, you know, regardless of the past, right now is a witness to me. I don't feel comfortable with him currently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We learn a little bit more about Judge Lance Ito. And I laugh because he's kind of being portrayed very comically, don't you guys think?
A little
like...
Who? Ito?
Ito.
Yeah.
He was kind of comical at the time.
And I heard, that his courtroom was a circus and he didn't have a hold on the courtroom. Oh, yeah.
And you saw that he kind of liked the fact that he had this Vanity Fair reporter, was it?
And then he takes out his Arsenio Hall photograph.
It's tough for him because he was the first judge that was really in the spotlight of, you know, with having the entire country as well as probably the entire world watching what was happening moment to moment. So he was in a really tough place, but he was a celebrity struck just like everybody else. And it was comical. They had, like they said, the dancing Judge Ito's on nighttime television.
That's probably why. Makes more sense now.
Yeah, it was crazy, and he had a lot to deal with.
We get into the pretrial motion. Wow, wow, wow.
Yeah.
The defense is trying to dismiss 62 domestic violence allegations. Mm-hmm. And I was like, there's no way they did this. And I looked it up, and they did try to do this.
Yeah.
It blows my mind, Shaka, as an attorney, where you're like, what?
Well, you know, there's something in the law where something is more prejudicial than it is probative. And, you know, domestic violence, again, and we remember we have this idea that it does lead to murder, but really domestic violence and murder are two very different things, you know. There are a lot of people who are abusers who are not murderers, you know. And so the worry for the jury is introducing this evidence going to prejudice the client too much, not based on the actual evidence of the murder, but mm-hmm. just based on knowing he's beaten his wife or there's 62 incidences of right. domestic abuse. So it's valid in the argument, you know, but kind of, you know, if you kind of feel he's done it and you feel like, why would you exclude this? Or if you feel it's really indicative of his nature, but the argument is that it could harm the jury's sense of what really happened that mm-hmm. night.
I know, because it's funny when you hear Shapiro say, this isn't a domestic violence trial, yeah. it's a murder trial.
Yeah. And the flip side is true when they were attacking Furman. You know, the use of the N-word, you know, necessarily might be too prejudicial than it is probative, but certainly the way Darden brought it up
Can you elaborate on how you felt about that? Like, would you say you agreed with what Darden had to say or with what Cochran had to say?
Darden went too far to me. Okay. Yeah. I mean, now if you tell people, you know, someone's past use of the N-word may prejudice them too much, may prejudice the jury too much of that person in terms of believing their truthfulness on everything else,
mm-hmm.
that's one argument. You know, if I know you said the N-word, I might just wholly not believe you, and that's not necessarily a logical nexus between what you did in the past and what you're saying now on the stand.
Mm-hmm.
So that argument I get, but what Darden was doing was indicting African Americans.
Yeah.
He was saying that they will not be able, they'll be so emotionally, you know, shaken by the word, they can't take this person seriously.
Yes.
And so when you start to target a particular group and say that something they've lived with and have dealt with on a daily basis, you know.
See, I think Darden was sincere when he said it, and I think that he was coming from the right place because the Los Angeles at the time was ripped apart by this racial tension that was happening with after Rodney King. And I think that, you know, Johnny Cochran just played it up, and he had excellent lawyering capability, and he was able to use his oratory skills
I can't
sway the jury.
On that one, hearing
I agree
N-word,
too.
Yeah,
because
not ruin your skills of analysis.
That's my point too. Because yeah. I liked when he said they live with offensive treatment.
Yeah.
And the reason why I said that, and you see the reactions of certain black people in that courtroom when they're like, wait. Bro, like, I hope you're not putting me a part of this argument, because my whole thing is that there's plenty of people that I hear around me who say that because of the certain ways that they grew up. Some people use N-I-G-G-A instead of E-R, whatever it is, the case may be. I'm not going to be like, don't you ever talk to me again.
Yeah.
I'm relaxed. I get it. You may come from a different part, but I'm going to hear it. I get why you might say why
but
you
But when you
not.
Weigh it up against the 62 cases of abuse that they, because you were coming from was you said that they were attempting to off those, and you got how that could be prejudicial, but the use of the N-word so prolifically was prejudicial as well.
I'm weighing
the two against each other
I
say that.
I can see how it's prejudicial to people in general. I can't see why you would say African Americans are incapable of having any reasonable analysis, and that's what Darden said.
Oh,
he didn't say this is to the general jury prejudicial.
No, I would have thought to the country as a whole it could be inflammatory with what was happening and stuff like that. But
because for that argument, it's for the jury. It's an argument for the entirety of the jury.
Right.
Yes.
But he was calling out
African Americans.
Got it.
And that's what was offensive. It was just like, wow, yeah.
So the last part of that scene, what Cochran says, actually happened.
Wow.
Yeah.
I looked it up.
It all happened.
Yeah, some parts, and we'll get to the part about the heart attack that Hodgman had
Bill
didn't
Hodgman.
Really happen in the courthouse.
Oh, they put
he
it
He started
in
having chest pains later on. So there's some things that they did for TV effect, but...
But in that line that Johnny says to Cochran, I think
It was showing him.
Yeah, it's great to hear that it actually happened because it captured the essence of your anger in that one moment.
With
you just really tell us as a people we could not understand.
When he said,
it was so offensive, and it was just like, how do you get that across?
Right.
And it was like brother to brother, he was just like, please, are you kidding
right.
me? So yeah, I really got that scene. I really love that it was a real moment.
So did I, because I'm glad that he used it to be like, how do you feel about me using that word right now?
Yeah.
Like, are you incapable of being the second prosecutor
and
to this case now?
He gave this beautiful kind of cogent, educated comeback of
absolutely.
Disgust, but in two words, it just summarizes it all.
It sure
it was just like,
it was really good.
Yeah.
That was great.
So Cochran gets a phone call. He's hanging out with Dale, Keisha Sharp. Hi, we love you.
Yeah. they were hanging out. Sorry about that interruption.
Roads are coming up.
She's doing great.
She is. And he gets a phone call saying that they forgot to submit 12 witnesses' names.
Yeah.
And Cochran's like, we're going anyway.
Yeah. You were talking about it because I freaked out when Bill freaked out, but you were saying that's a big
deal.
One thing that Cochran handled that really smoothly, because that's a big deal to when your witnesses are not in evidence. That's a very big deal because they'll likely get excluded, and you cannot in an opening statement talk about evidence you're going to put on that has not been admitted. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of a general no-no. I can't tell you my client's going to get off when you see the murder victim walk through this court door and knowing full well it's not happening or there's no evidence to support it. And so that was a big issue. So that's why he was going crazy at that table to hear them start listing witness after witness after witness.
None of whom had been disclosed.
No one had been disclosed. But what's more than that, it's also a big no-no for an attorney to interrupt an opening statement.
Mm-hmm.
It just generally does not happen. And when you interrupt an opening statement, it looks like you're trying to hide something from the jury.
Mm-hmm.
And so objections are very, you may have all these legal reasons to make them, but you're very discreet with them. You have like a very analysis based on, I don't want the jury to make it appear that I'm trying to hide something from them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you use your objections wisely, right?
Yes.
So now here he is, all these witnesses that haven't disclosed, and now he has to make this objection during opening. So he's just really kind of freaking out.
Right.
So I got the anxiety and like.
I was gonna say kudos to that actor. I hope he wins an Emmy for like support or something, because I literally like stopped everyone. We had a pause and I was like, what's happening right now? And I freaked out. That was like
the
really
way
well.
Shaking
it was just really well done, and it was super emotional. And, and like that's how I knew. And I had to ask Shaka. I was like, "What happened? You know, like, oh my god."
Yeah,
I can feel it still.
He brought the emotion because you're like, you're on the edge of your seat, I felt it for him. I was like, you know, as an attorney,
how nerve wracking
to object, and now you're dealing with all these witnesses, and he was just
and he got emotional. And I think that's what really upset me, because this is a grown ass man in the court after I had already made a comment. If you were a woman doing that, you know, you'd be laughed at.
Yeah,
that's
so
true.
And it's his first day and his biggest, you know, court case.
It was, everybody was emotionally involved because it was such a big deal. There was so much weight and gravitas to this case that it's like, and this episode was pushing everybody's emotional button.
Absolutely.
I was feeling it. I was
of
like,
course.
You saw how it would pull you from whatever racial divide you came from or side or whatever.
Which Shaka and I both said, we literally made the same comment. We see why this case was so easily made out of race. Yeah.
But I think in this episode, you start to see that, okay, it looks like there's some valid reasons why you might vote or might say he's not guilty that did not fall along racial lines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way they're setting up the case, it looks like to me so far the defense is just putting on a better case.
Right.
And as a jury member, you're not really privy to everything outside.
Hard.
So
they take a recess.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel like, did they already taint the view
of
right?
Yeah.
From the guy, I mean, it hasn't even officially started yet.
Yeah.
And the jury's already heard that this, you know, these random witnesses are being brought up, and I don't know.
And what do you think as a jury member when the defense is mentioning all the witnesses you're going to hear from the prosecution it mentioned, and they stand up and object, and now you've been let out?
And the prosecution looks like they have no idea what they're doing.
Right.
So what's the prosecution trying to hide is my first question.
Exactly.
Right.
So as a juror, you're like, what am I getting myself into?
Yeah.
This
yeah.
is insane.
Or thinking, oh, wow, there's all these witnesses, and look, these guys didn't do their job. They're standing there looking like fools.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's any interviews on the jurors. Does anybody know of any?
There are out there. I don't know where they
are.
I really want to hear their thought process throughout this whole thing. Like, what were you thinking? So let's talk about how they go to OJ's house.
Okay. Good? Because...
Go ahead. Take it away.
Well, because we had... earlier in the season, we had someone send us that video of The View. Thank you to that viewer. Forgive me for not having your name down. But she, during the interview with Marsha Clark, she remembers that part specifically about her had walking through the house before and how they redecorated everything. And it upsets me because, you know, they didn't give the proper representation of who OJ was. However, what was funny to me during that whole thing, and we'll focus more on the decoration, but was OJ's reaction when Darden sat on the bench.
Oh.
I felt like, so the jurors were like, oh, well, look at his fuse.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But anyways.
Not a good moment.
Oh, see, I didn't. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I just.
Not a good moment for him.
That wasn't a good moment for him.
Again, you had mentioned something. You said that you can change that, right?
Well, you know, if they're going to the house to see it for, you know, purposes of why blood might have ended up somewhere, you can't, like, build a wall that would obstruct that from ever happening. Mm-hmm. But they weren't entering for decorations. They weren't entering, you know, to inspect furnishings. So they could change it. Right? And especially if there was no order, you know, put forth by the prosecution, that they must remain.
See, I think they would be able to object to that legally, and but once it's in their consciousness, you can't take it back.
That's true.
Yeah.
Oh, so there would be no point.
Yeah. It's okay, pretend you didn't see that.
Right.
But wasn't the house at some point a crime scene?
Yeah.
And so you can go back and change what was a crime scene.
Well, it's not a crime scene now. Yeah, it's not a crime scene currently. And so, and I'm guessing OJ probably owned Nicole's house, but somehow I wonder if it looked like the defense probably got rid of all her stuff out of her house.
Yeah,
it
looked like it was because
all the family pictures. That's what Marsha was saying. She's like, she had a family.
She had this, and
none of that was there.
And if the defense did that, then that's exactly what you would do, because you don't want them getting very personal with the victim. You don't want them to relate to the victim, but you want them to relate to your client and really get an emotional connection with him.
It was just ridiculous. And then what blew my mind was OJ said, "Those aren't even my kids."
I don't even know these people. Yeah.
So that was the. That was the kind of the instance of where you see that race is a big issue. It's a valid issue, but now Johnny's really using it as a weapon, you know, as a sword.
And you see how OJ feels too, because prior to that tour of the house, we see a conversation between Cochran and OJ when he's prepping him about the decorations in the house, and there's a couple of things again, like what Heather had said last week. She said, you know, the thing about OJ was that he was a friendly guy. Everyone did like him, and that's why everyone had this very specific perception of him and could be on his side. He, you know, was looking around the house, almost upset, like, because he had nothing to be ashamed of.
Yeah.
Meaning he was proud of what it looked like, and what he wanted to decorate was what he wanted to decorate. But I really did like the moment that he said he's not going to feel bad for buying a beautiful house in a beautiful neighborhood.
Yeah.
And the one thing I just want to say to that is just, I think I agree with that, just because, you know, I know plenty of people, myself included, where we've been in situations like, please don't make me feel bad or tell me that I'm not what I am because I... you know, like, for instance, like that, because I like to say, because I speak English well, I don't know how many times people have said, like, oh, you don't have an accent.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I never said I wasn't born.
It's because you worked.
I never said I wasn't born.
You worked your ass off, and that's the thing.
Right.
OJ worked his ass off to get to where he was.
That's what I'm saying. So, don't discredit me.
Yeah.
And I feel bad for OJ a little bit during that part.
Well, it's one of those things.
I do. I'm sorry.
He really had worked for something, and he thought he had kind of transcended these racial lines. It's like when Johnny got stopped, he was just very well aware he had not. That was an issue that would always be around, regardless of how wealthy you got or who you were.
That's a great point. I don't disregard it. The two of them view that. Wow.
And OJ just felt like he had escaped it, that he had, you know, he had achieved enough that no one had to look at him due to his race.
And then they made it all about that, it tore him apart.
Yeah, and you almost feel like if it was anything less than double murder, he would have, like, you know, put a kibosh on everything. You know, said, forget about race, don't use it.
He did not want to be known as black. And that's the part that kind of hits you. OJ didn't want to be black. And he said, I'm not black, I'm OJ, from the episode before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sad that somebody would think that striving to the top or making it would be associated with the color of your skin.
Well, I think he just felt like,
coming from where he came from,
people should now be colorblind at this point because I am now OJ.
Yeah.
So because I know the way they view black people, no one views me that way, so I have transcended that. I am OJ.
Then that was a naive part of him.
Yeah.
I'm going to interrupt for 2 seconds and just to repeat the hashtag again. I'm getting service and I don't see no tweets.
Don't see no tweets.
What? That's a lie. I tweeted you.
Oh. Did you? Oh, wait, just a second, because I didn't check my notifications. I was checking the
Stephanie?
Hashtag. No, ABTV ACS.
Okay, good. Awesome. Nice. Keep them going.
Oh, no, I do see it.
Oh, very nice.
Oh.
Okay. But it also reminds you, you know, you think of Michael Jackson, who was, you know, the skin, the lightening of the skin and the facial features and stuff, and it's like this whole idea that Keisha had brought up last week when she was here about having the white wife, and there's the kind of the striving and stepping over and then no longer associating with the people that were there before. And when it was really surreal to look at that room of, you said it was writers, the guy was a writer at the table, and it was very white. It was a very white party where they're, you know,
oh, I know, they're fine dining. So, get out of here. That was a four or five course. Get out of here.
Just a surreal, like, really? Are you kidding me? They've got so much poshness and money and white. And it's like, wow, does that really exist?
It does, but they did a bad job because they weren't doing open arm service, which was you're supposed to do in a situation. So I'm kidding. That was a joke. It wasn't a good one. Nothing. But the way that all the servers were serving the plates was improper.
Wow, I love it, you guys. I'm learning something new.
But I'm talking as a server, not as the person sitting on the table.
But what a contrast of the way that they were discussing the case versus the way you've seen other groups of people talk about the case.
It was a good episode. Yeah. They really played the race.
Oh, man.
Actually, what did you guys think about some of the things, like how they were conversing about it? I felt like it wasn't necessarily bad. It was more so the gossip of it, right?
Yeah. Just purely gossip. Cannot believe,
And that man's daughter was murdered.
Yeah.
So
He's a columnist for Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how Cochran goes up to Darden at OJ's house and he goes, do not do Mark Furman.
Yeah.
Yep.
Let the white people do it.
Yeah.
Because of the evidence that they have, or like Cochran figured it out later, the witness that they might have.
So at this point, we're thinking that Cochran's actually trying to help Darden out.
Yeah. Absolutely.
There's no ill intention there.
I think he knows that they're going to eviscerate Mark Furman and Cochran, and Darden's going to look like an idiot if he's the one that puts him up.
Right.
And he's giving him a little advice, you know. You already made a mistake. Don't make another one,
Okay, I didn't pick that. I was trying to figure that out still. But okay, so it was the real deal.
It was the way his father said that. From one black man to another, like, he's just trying to look out for you and just kind of take that for what it is instead of feeling so attacked at this moment just because of what's going on.
And I think it represented the sentiment of the black community in the case.
Absolutely.
And so his father kind of got it and said, he's probably trying to help you out because I had that same sentiment. You know what I mean?
Of course.
And so I think that's where that came from,
That's fascinating. And because, I mean, it turns out that, like, Mark Furman's used the N-word 700 times or something. I mean, it's so immense where he was coming from that
we saw earlier in the episode the defense team say there's no way they're going to put Furman up, you know, because
he's going to shred him.
So we'll be ready to get him, so they probably won't put him up.
Yeah.
But, and I think Johnny was alluding to that fact that, you know, they won't put him up, but if they do, don't want to be you.
Don't be in the line of fire.
And I'm happy that I feel like the exchange of words in the moment where Darden gets Marsha to be like, fine, I'm going to do it anyways. She did it, I feel like, in a way where it would almost be like a reverse psychology for him to be like, you know what, no, I'll do it. And he's like, thank you, and walked out. And I was like, good. I'm so happy he didn't ad lib to that, nor did he say thank you, just walked out, because that's all he needed to do so it wouldn't be used against him because... Yeah, well, don't know what's about to happen.
That Uncle Tom theme came up a couple of times in the episode.
It's unfortunate. Yeah. I saw it coming before it was said, before he read it on the newspaper. Yeah. I'm like, great, he's going to be called that.
Yeah. And then we got it with OJ. The mayor of Brentwood. He goes, I know what that really means. Yes. And that was the same sort of reference.
That he had sold out his own people.
Yeah.
And so that whole theme of it, and it's to some degree... One would look at OJ and say, well, he kind of did. He was so anxious to get away from everything that was black that it was. Do you think?
Well, I see how people could interpret it that way, but I think.
Yeah, I could be wrong.
But I would say what was more important was the fact that you didn't see it in the trial.
Mm.
So, you know, Darden gets painted as his Uncle Tom. While people may have had that perception of OJ, we get his lawyer coming in and changing the decoration of the house. So, if that were to ever arise in someone's mind, it was gone.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was gone from outward view.
What a crazy episode. That's pretty much it. We're already on episode 5.
Yeah, crazy.
We only have 5 more left, and it's just getting better and better.
It's funny, too, because I'm like, how are they going to make this 10 episodes? And now I'm thinking, how is there only going to be 5 left?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? There's so much to go.
Right.
Like, so much to cover.
And I love that, just I have to go back to that opening line that with Johnny Cochran.
Yeah, let's go. Let's go back to anything.
Add in whatever you guys.
There were just 2 things I thought were really powerful. The MLK line, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
Yes, I wrote it down
everywhere.
Too.
Oh, yeah.
But what's brilliant about that line, it almost allows people in the jury to go, well, maybe, you know, we never got justice for Rodney. So now, because, you know, injustice anywhere, you know, is a threat to justice everywhere. So maybe that injustice was a threat to justice here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it almost allowed for that kind of thinking to seep in of, you know, possibly making up for what happened in the past. Mm-hmm. And then we also had just, he's going with his wife, contaminated, compromised, and corrupted. And so we already see the inner workings of Johnny's mind and how he's able to get, just from a strategic point, into the jury's head. Mm-hmm. And so it's really setting up a legal case that looks so strong on the defense side. Mm-hmm. Just aside from actual guilt or innocence, you really see the defense putting together such a cogent argument mm-hmm. and a great way to kind of like tell their story.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. And it made me think, specifically when he said that an injustice anywhere is an injustice everywhere, I couldn't help but think that, you know what? He's right. And forgive me, you know, I'm so sorry, Brown family, and I'm so sorry, Goldman family, that where I almost wanted to be like, if I could talk to someone or if I was a part of that team, I'd be like, we don't want to discredit their murders, but because of the status of O.J. Simpson and how people knew him, it was an opportunity to get justice of something. Yeah. You know, and again, like I said, I don't want to be desensitized to these two people who were murdered, and that sucks, and someone should get in trouble for it, and so on and so forth. But it's just one of those things that in life that it happens. Yeah. I mean, how many other lives of other minorities were just as equally discredited, but never spoken about so sadly the way that we are about their lives?
We have to be careful with that, though, too, because like part of it is, you know, for Johnny Cochran, what he's brilliant at is he has the ability to move people's hearts, and he had the mm-hmm. ability to move people's hearts and minds and to transport. And what he was essentially saying was, this is not about O.J. Simpson. This is about black people in America. And we've been, you know, we've been held down. We've been pushed back. The police will plant things on us. We are being oppressed still. Right. And he was able to move, even as we watch it today, through an actor, he was able to move people's hearts in that direction. And we have to remember that two people died, and that's what's on trial. But this is the whole thing of the O.J. Simpson phenomena, is that it was not just those two people on trial, but it should have been. Those people deserved to have it be about them. And unfortunately, I think in places it got lost because they had incredible lawyers who were well practiced. I mean, he was a preacher like MLK.
I think just, and the other subject, to a certain part, it's almost as if they just kind of forgot about OJ being a part of it too, and it just became its own thing. But I feel like the big thing also is that there are other races that are identifying it with too. You know, like my Middle Eastern friends and my Latino friends and Asian friends, like everyone is kind of
minorities, women,
that's what I'm saying.
Men.
But I would say with a theme, he at least, we haven't seen the whole thing, but I'm kind of going based on the episodes. It's a theme he weaves without saying it. So he's still providing a legal analysis of the case, saying we're going to present these witnesses. But he just puts these things in your mind.
And you formulate the thought yourself. Yeah. He doesn't have to say it.
Yeah. Yes. So you're not actually going, I'm getting justice for past stuff.
Yes.
But it's just in your mind that we've really been held down for a long time. Let's look at the evidence. But now you're coming at it from a different angle.
Right. And you can only do that with a very educational statement.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You can't just be using basic words and then and put the exact same thought in everybody's mind and without having been able to describe it and show it the way that he did.
And that's what I like, at least, about this series, because I hate hearing stuff of, well, you think O.J. is not guilty because you're black.
I think
he's not guilty because of the way the evidence was presented by the defense. I think they just had a better narrative, and based on the evidence presented, that's why I think so.
That's exactly what happened. And not that the jury didn't do their job either at the end of the day. The jury did exactly what was their job, and he got off because the story was a better
story.
It was a better defense.
Incredible. Think about.
Man. Yeah. It makes me so sad too that something like this happened to them, but it would only happen then because we haven't, I mean, more or less evolved, because we've had kind of similar issues now, which is crazy.
But put the shoe on the other foot for a second, because OJ could afford it. What happens if that other person was you?
Right.
And you didn't.
Bye, everybody.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And you couldn't afford that dream team, and they were coming after you, and they had the dream team against you, but you didn't do it.
Right.
Yeah.
You'd be screwed.
It does. That's true.
So it can often become a money game, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it says something about justice in America. That's the problem.
Because if Marsha had three or four more attorneys on her side that said, hey, idiot, look, this is an actual issue in the case, race is an issue, she probably would have backed down and started to redo things, but they didn't have a team of lawyers to go in and have people drill into her mind, you know.
because she refused to believe that race would still be an issue. Yeah.
What it says to me is that money is a bigger threat in America than we think it is. If you're on the poverty side of the fence, regardless of the color of your skin,
right?
You're
Trump,
screwed. And if you're at the top echelon, regardless of the color of your skin, you can buy the best defense that money can buy, and they're going to tell the story better.
And I think it's a dual theme we'll continue to see, because that same money didn't help Donnie from getting stopped, or you know, or not money necessarily, but Darden's dealing with these, you know, things of affirmative action, and you know, so having prominence and money can sometimes help, but then you see that sometimes you have it battling against each other, where you can't escape, you know.
You see, and that's the thing. I did my mock trial in high school was for affirmative action, and that was the
Mine
one
too.
Thing.
Was it?
So that, and I was a prosecutor because I went against it, and it was weird because the people that were going for it were both. White boys. They're white guys. And it was just weird because you would think that it would be the other way around, but my teacher, he did it very specifically that way. And then my whole argument was that I never want to be second guessed for the education or for what I earned.
Yeah.
Right. So, I won that case.
You can say crackers. That's all right.
You
can go.
Salty. You see, yeah, they have say that.
Yeah, that's all right.
I like pie with cheese. Thank you.
Episode. Where can everybody find you?
Y'all can find me on Twitter at Stephanie Georgie and on Instagram at TheStephanieGeorgie.
You can find me, Shaka Smith, on Twitter and Instagram at Shaka Strong.
And Chris Howard at Chris Howard Live and LegendaryLivingDaily.com and LegendaryLivingTV.com.
And you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Pegarad. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we will see you next week. Bye.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.